you. I will give a talk about three self-consistent n-body simulations of StarCrafters New Galactic Center. So they are my collaborators. Abstract. So there are young massive stars near the galactic center. This is the picture of observation. So a possible scenario for this formation is they are carried by clusters. For this scenario, we performed three self-consistent n-body simulation. So in this simulation, both clusters and the host galaxy are modeled by n-body system. And this simulation includes stellar collisions and formation of an IMBH in the cluster. And we developed a new code for this simulation. And we found if an IMBH formation occurred in a cluster, young stars are carried by 1-to-1 mean motion resonance. So outlines here. First, I introduce some observations and two scenarios for this formation, and introduce previous works and show our n-body simulation and result. Okay, introduction. So this is a picture of the observation. Around 100 young massive stars are found near the galactic center in one parsec. So they are several mega years old because they are OB stars. Some of them have eccentric orbit, and they are located on one or two disks. It's a little controversial.
Actually, so Andrea Ghez gave a talk at the AAS meeting, when was it, 3 weeks ago now, 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And the message from her, at least, seemed to be that this is pretty much settled now, and it is really one disk.
Okay.
Not that it makes a difference to you, but this, at least according to her, has pretty much been settled now. What? Do we care?
But it's not.
This is. I believe this is just based on having a lot better kinematic data now on a lot more of these stars and just being able to tell. I mean, the statistics were always for one of the two. The statistics were always very crummy. So now apparently it's been cleaned up.
So this assembly of stars is IRS-13E. They are co-moving stars. So they suggested it might have an IMBH in this IRS-13E. So it may be a remnant of a core of the star cluster. And S-stars is they are very close to the supermassive black hole. The distance is less than 0.01 parsec from the galactic center.
Sagittarius star is in the middle of this image?
Yeah, very around
here. So IRS-13 east is then a few tens of parsecs in projection?
Projection distance is 0.18 parsec from the galactic center.
Okay.
So normally, an in-situ formation in this region is difficult because of the strong tidal field of the supermassive black hole. So how they were formed is a problem. There are some scenarios for formation of them. One is in-situ formation. It's massive gaseous disk formed around the central massive black hole. So the disk became gravitationally unstable and fragmentation occurred in this disk. And the fragments crossed and formed stars. This is in situ formation.
Could you, when you get down to that point, could you remind me what defines an S star?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was on the previous slide as well. You get S star. When you get to that, can you explain briefly what that is? Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
What are S stars?
In this thing.
Yes.
No S stars.
You suppose that they can verify in relatively messy?
Okay.
So why do you call S?
I think not even Schödel could remember that. Point the term when he was really thinking hard why we call them S stars. It could just be source. We are just discovered as an infinite source.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so there are some simulations about it. It's an example of simulation. But this scenario has some problem. So how to make two disks, it may be solved. And it's difficult to make high eccentric orbit of stars. And it's also difficult to make a very compact system like IRS-13, and there's no scenario for S-stars.
Well, to play devil's advocate, it's just like extrasolar planets, right? They form out of disks, they should be on circular orbits, yet they seem to be all in highly eccentric orbits, and you find a lot that are very close to the star. So there are obviously ways around this that involve simple dynamical processes, if you wanted to.
And two disks now is not a problem.
Yeah, two disks. Mm. Two disks may not be a problem.
The other scenario is star cluster in spiral. So a star cluster formed a little farther from the galactic center, like Archer's cluster. It migrated through the dynamical friction, and maybe an INBH formed in it. And finally, it is disrupted by the tidal field of SMBH and remained stars. So this process occurred within several mega years. So this the good point of this scenario is it can explain some observations. So if the star cluster has initially eccentric orbit, it can make stars with eccentric orbit. And IRS-13E might be a remnant of core. So now, how fast or how deep the cluster can carry stars is a problem.
What does the mass of the IMBH and IRS-13E have to be?
It is suggested from 1,000 to 10 to the 4 solar masses, but not decided.
But it's not even close to the detection.
No. And, but I thought the issue was that to make an IMBH that massive, you had to make an awful lot of other stars that should be visible. Mm. Is that issue still around?
I'm sure she's going to get to that.
So this is an example of previous simulation. So there are some numerical simulations. So this in these papers, they calculated internal evolution of star cluster, and for the orbital evolution, they used semi-analytic model. So The orbital evolution was calculated semi-analytically using the Chandrasekhar dynamical friction formula. So the results show very massive or dense clusters can carry to the galactic center in a few mega years. But the orbital evolution might be incorrect. So this is the orbital evolution of satellite galaxy. Blue line shows the semi-analytic calculation like their paper. And this red curve shows full n-body simulation. They are the same simulation. So this figure shows the orbital evolution of satellite galaxy in full n-body simulation is much faster than in semi-analytic simulation. So this is...
Which one is right?
Red one. So there's a reason.
How would you know that? How would you know that?
I mean,
the question, of course, is n large enough to model this correctly? To model the background galaxy correctly? It's all about dynamical friction, right? And how you calculate it. So one is this semi-analytic prescription, which assumes a background density profile. And some version of the Chandrasekhar formula. Mm-hmm.
The problem is that to get the formula, you need mass. It's mass. It's hard to define the mass.
So,
Why is it?
The Chandrasekhar formula has a certain object and a certain mass moving through some light background.
Yeah.
But in the case of the cluster, what exactly do you mean by the mass? For example, what we did was just to compute the mass inside the Jacobi radius, which is does not include the escape.
Right, and that's the
this little point. Little picture says it all, right?
Yeah.
The
I want to
contribute to
that. Can you intuitively explain the picture? Why does it so much enhance the white effect?
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So we found two mechanisms enhance dynamical friction. It's not dynamical friction, but so when start escaping from the satellite, they remove angular momentum from the satellite. So this is the reason one. So two is the enhancement of dynamical friction. So normally, when calculate semi-analytic orbital evolution, we use bound mass of satellite. But in real n-body simulation, there are many stars around the satellite. So the friction works for all mass of them. So the real friction is larger than calculated by the friction formula.
You verify that if you replace your cluster with a point mass, you get something closer to the semi-analytic? If you replace the cluster with a point mass, you don't have these enhanced escapers.
Yeah. If calculate in point mass, no mass loss, it's rather similar to friction body simulation.
Did you try the calculation where you simply remove the escapers from the calculation instead of letting them handle the cluster?
Sorry, what?
If you simply in your n-body simulation, if you something is an escaper, if you actually just remove it from the simulation, then you should be able to see this effect.
It should slow down.
The dynamical friction should be less if you actually remove the escapers instead of letting them stay.
Yeah.
So you can test this model.
So this line maybe you mentioned. So in this calculation, we use the mass obtained from this red one. So and calculate but this orbital evolution is calculated in analytical way.
When you do the analytic calculation, do you consider the cluster as a point mass or extended mass? Because it will make some difference. So if you assume the point mass for semi analytic calculations, you're not comparing actually the
In this simulation, we use point mass, but little embedded point mass using soft wings, larger soft wings.
So I still didn't quite get this. So what you call the blue curve there, the semi-analytic, is what exactly? There's still a part of that is still n-body simulation. It's not,
fully analytic.
Completely analytic. So with a fixed background for the galaxy and point mass following. Okay, that's the blue curve. And the red curve is full n-body, both the background galaxy and the cluster.
If you
do an n-body simulation with the cluster modeled as a single point mass, fixed mass, mm-hmm. but you still treat the background in exactly the same way with your n-body simulation. Have you run that?
Maybe, yes.
Okay, and then do you get, when you did that, did mm-hmm. you get a curve that looked more like the blue curve or more like the red curve?
Red curve, very fast, faster than this red curve, because because it does not lose mass.
So it should be below the red curve.
Yeah, similar to red curve.
You mean the blue? Hmm? I think you just said the other way.
No, I think she means it's because you artificially keep the mass constant.
If you don't lose any mass at all, that would be the fastest.
Faster than red curve.
Semi-analytic model, if you just have to assign a mass, it underestimates the cluster mass in the red model somewhere in between.
Okay, then why do we see the difference between the semi-analytic calculation and the point mass and body simulation?
Because the semi-analytic has got a mass for the cluster.
It has a prescription for mass loss already, the semi-analytic.
Oh, okay.
So I guess what I'm then really asking is, did you test how your n-body simulation treats, produces dynamical friction compared to the analytic treatment by doing, on the one hand, so not this semi-analytic treatment, but the analytic treatment for a fixed point mass, just spiral in with the Chandrasekhar formula in the fixed background. Okay, that's not the blue curve, that's some other curve. And the same thing with a fixed point mass, but done with your direct n-body simulation in the background, just as a test. This is just to see, to test purely the dynamical friction treatment in your n-body simulation.
What do you learn from that? You learn whether or not the Chandrasekhar formula is correct.
Well, how we turn it around, it's capable of producing it. You're
interacting with your own wake, so it's not clear that the Chandrasekhar formula formalism is correct anyway.
Right. So if you have you have a lot of slides left, right?
So
time's up.
There's a comment.
First, I would like to know the scales of that graph in view of the application. For example, the size of the cluster, how would it compare with the radius scale? That's one question. And one comment is that some of the questions you were asking about studying the dynamical friction on a rigid point mass or rigid extended point mass have been carried out by Elena in the last couple of years. The published papers show that the Chandrasekhar formula naively overestimates the friction time.
On a circular orbit?
all the kind of orbits. She tried both circular orbits, all the radial orbits. Arena is the person. And she checked that typically you have, because of the waves, you have a tendency to have gentler friction, milder friction. That's the
common. But then it's not exactly the effect of escapers.
That's not the effect of escapers. It was one of the reference points to be compared to.
So it would be worth doing the test where you just did the point mass calculation.
Point mass and
point mass cluster moving in the background of the galaxy.
Maybe not. I don't remember, but I tried at some point point mass simulation. Can I go ahead? Okay, let's discuss later. Okay, previous simulation too. This simulation treats both star cluster and galaxy using n-body model. And this model contains initial and IMVH in this cluster. So this IMVH makes a cluster survive longer than no IMVH cluster. But in this simulation, they could not treat the internal motion of cluster. So this is because they use a tree code. So, no. There are no simulation. It can treat the internal motion and orbital evolution of star cluster at the same time, because it was difficult to treat both at the same time. So the reason is star cluster is a small system, but it needs very high accuracy for calculation. So people use direct summation and Hermite integrator for this calculation. But the cost is order of n squared. It's very expensive. On the other hand, for galaxy, galaxy is large n system, so it needs very fast scheme for calculation. So people use tree and leapfrog integrator. But this scheme is not so high accuracy. So it's impossible to calculate star cluster in this way. And well, if you use this direct and Hermite integrator for galaxy, it takes too long time to calculation.
Can I ask a naive question? What exactly tree integrator loses compared to direct integrator? Well, it's maybe too many people. Just what exactly is lost if you use a tree integrator?
So it's just you're not doing the direct summation between all particles.
But what kind of interactions do you lose as a result?
Relaxation.
You lose accuracy.
Small scale force fluctuation
slows down. So for this simulation, we need very small time step. In this integrator, we often use individual time step, but it's difficult for tree code. So in each step, we have to make tree and calculate them. So this is the reason.
It
if a star escapes from the cluster, then do you treat it as a
as a direct? Now we treat direct, but it has very long time steps, so it's almost the same on this integrator.
Are time steps adaptive or fixed time?
Adaptive for inside cluster.
It's still some. It's time reversible or?
No, not time reversal for this part.
Okay.
Well, so we developed new scheme bridge. It's a direct and tree hybrid code. So in this code, only interaction between subclusters are calculated by this scheme, direct and Hamite integrator. And all the other interactions are calculated by tree and leapfrog integrator. And we combine them. So this code can treat large end system with small scale system was free self consistently, and it passed. So this is a model we used. So 2 million particles for galaxy and SMVH in the center of the galaxy. And we used also King model 64K particles for star cluster. And we adapted stellar collisions and IMVH formation in the star cluster. And mass loss due to the stellar wind. It's a very simple model like this. So for mass loss and collisions, we tried some parameters. So now I will show you a movie of this simulation. In this movie, only the star cluster is plotted.
Before you get to the movie, why not just model the galaxy background directly from observations? Why take this king model? Isn't that weird? Why not just construct a model that fits the observations?
Constant density.
Or even something simple, but I don't understand why in that plot there, your model is the red curve, right?
Yeah.
But then you show observed profiles. Why not just use the observed profile?
It's not that easy to make a galaxy in equilibrium with an exact density with a black hole, particularly.
Really? I would think people have been doing this, people like you have been doing this for decades.
Yeah.
No?
Kim Dan, but it's a huge job to begin with.
Really?
So for a given analytical or even density profile, you cannot create initial conditions with the density profile. Is that what?
I guess, but on the other hand, your King model there. I mean, by the time you put the black hole, it's something else anyway, so...
Yeah, well...
You grow it adiabatically, or...?
We put this King model on SMBH, so and calculate to around 1 or 2 dynamical times on the galaxy. So it makes this...
You mean it's not an equilibrium, but on the time scale of your simulation, it has no time to evolve much. Is that what you're saying?
No, I agree.
I mean,
it's
the
not
King.
Even if you just take a King model and take a black hole.
I mean, the King model does not have a black hole, right?
No.
So it's an equilibrium static model only without the black hole. By the time you put in the black hole with the mass ratio roughly 1 to 10, your King model is not a good model anymore.
But this doesn't look like a King model. Is this red line your model after a few dynamical times or something?
Yeah.
So it's coming to some sort of...
So you take a King model, you add the black hole, and then you let it relax. Or
virilize,
thank you.
Yeah.
Violently relax.
Yeah, react.
Is that how you set up the galaxy model?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you start, and then you add the star cluster.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I'm sorry. What's up? Oh, okay, sir. So left is projection on XY plane, and this is XZ plane. The cluster starts around 10 parsecs from the galactic center, and it was this.
Size of the mass of the star?
Yeah, it depends on the mass of stars, but only five kind of. So it is disrupted by the tidal force. Okay, almost done.
This star cluster had a black hole?
Yes, around 2.3 mega years.
What?
This red cross is the point.
The red cross is the point.
Okay.
Okay.
I have better.
And this is a black hole that formed through collisions in self-consistently during the early dynamic
collisions. Okay. So this is it's the same snapshot that the previous simulation.
What's the mass of the IMDH?
Okay, I will show next slide.
Okay.
So this is the IMDH. The hole in the center become smaller and smaller. So it shows the stars were carried. And this is a home comparison with observation. This is the result of simulation. It's K-band image of the galactic center. So they are very similar. And this is evolution of star cluster. So orbital evolution and bound mass evolution. And this is mass of the most massive star in the cluster. So we assumed that the most massive star formed an IMBH after its main sequence lifetime and without mass loss. So this is the time formation of IMBH.
So is that about one-tenth of the cluster mass? The mass of this is about 10% of the cluster mass?
Yes, around 10%.
Well, it looks like it's almost all the cluster mass. If you look at the bound mass of the cluster,
it's almost... Yeah, on here, it's only, almost only an IMBH.
It starts growing at T equals zero.
Yeah, this is what you were discussing last week. These are these kinds of initial conditions where basically immediately you start.
You said there was no mass loss from the growing...
Mass loss is around here.
Yeah.
This means... The formation of IMBH.
What's the initial mass function you assume for the stars?
Sulfur mass function.
Okay,
one, two.
The limits?
1 to 100 from.
It really matter so high instantly.
How many, I must have missed it, how many stars were in the N body, the direct N body simulation?
64K.
64K. 64. The mean mass, what's the mass limit on the Salpeter function?
mean mass is 1.3 sorry mass. True. Back to here. No. So, well, around here, the number of bound star to the MBH is less than 10, almost disrupted here. But many stars were carried to the inner 1%. So this is a new scenario to carry stars. This black line shows the orbital evolution of a star. It escaped around here, but its orbit is following to the cluster or INBH orbit. So what happened? This is a red and this red blue stars show an orbit of the star, and black is the orbit of INBH. And the same thing in rotational frame, fixed INBH here. So these stars are caught in the resonance of SMBH and INBH. So it's the one-to-one mean motion resonance. It's famous of Trojan stars and Jupiter. So this INBH star around here and migrate to the SMBH by the dynamical friction. These stars in resonance followed this INBH.
What about L5? Is there a Lagrange point in the opposite side of the
dynamic? Yeah, L5.
You just didn't draw that?
No, not only few stars, yeah. Many stars moving around here, like horseshoe orbit. So some stars temporary here.
So in your picture, the disk would be what we saw forming initially, and then the S stars you would get by bringing them all the way in through this process?
Yeah, I think so.
Now, it wasn't there, and so there would be an IMBH currently in IRS 13, where you're... I thought there was a limit from the proper motion of Sat J star that was more like 1,000 solar masses already. Okay. I thought you could basically rule out observationally the presence of a 10 to 4 solar mass black hole anywhere in that region now.
Yeah. So, well, at one point it will occur if the mass of IMBH is less than 10 to the 4 solar masses. So I tried many simulations. And the next is, so another
gravitational wave emission. If you carry all the S stars down to 1 million cluster, then it's just a matter of million years.
Yes, of course. If you say by now it's gone already, then that's fine. Of course, then you run into another problem though. That, you know, unless we're at an extremely special time, this has all happened in the last few million years, right? Well, you can't bring 10 to the 4 solar masses into that black hole every few million years, right? Because then we would have something much bigger at the center of our galaxy right now. You can do it though if you do it 1,000 solar masses every few million years. In fact, then you get it about right.
Have you tried?
Have
you seen how it works also for lower IMH
mass? Yeah, I tried. Well, I have more simulations, so wait.
Yeah,
So I write some simulation, but not no mass of IMH. So in this simulation, in this simulation, the mass of NBH is 5,000, and this is around 3,000, and this 8,001, almost 10,000. So I try some. So they are using different different parameters for mass loss and stellar collision.
So the problem we ran into when I did this with Atakan Gorkan was that if you don't want to take these very extreme initial conditions where collisions start right away and you can build a black hole very quickly, which I think is very artificial, you need to start with much bigger clusters, superstar clusters, a million solar masses. Which is fine because you can then even start them way out where we know there's molecular gas. You can start them at, you know, 100 parsecs if you want. And you can form the black hole and you can make all of that work. I think, well, we may be off by 50% because we didn't do the dynamic friction completely right, but I think qualitatively it's actually more reasonable. But the problem we ran into, which was then picked up by Nyakshin and turned into basically a death sentence for this scenario, is that with, if you start with these much bigger clusters way out and you let them spiral in, they would have left behind an enormous number of massive stars that would be outside of a parsec. And we don't see them.
No.
So maybe the way, I mean, at some level, the way you do it here helps in a sense, because by converting a much larger fraction of the total cluster mass into the black hole, maybe you avoid a little bit this problem because you have fewer stars that will have been left behind. And by pushing it, you know, to start the cluster much closer, also you maybe you avoid a bit of the problem further out. But it is a bit artificial, I think, to push it in this direction. So I don't know if you have you looked specifically at how many massive stars are left behind, you know, between 10 and 1 parsec there, for example, in your upper left. But your simulations tell you, you know, how many, and you see them in your movies. There's a lot of massive stars that would be outside of the central parsec. They're not seen, right?
Well, but it, but not observed outer one parsec.
Right.
Not enough. No.
Maybe they are there, but they haven't been seen because of patchy obscuration and things like that, but it's. I think if you talk to the observers, they will tell you it's, you're really pushing it if you want to hide that many, because they would be spread all around.
Right, I mean,
that region, right?
It's even worse, it's 0.4 parsecs. Almost all bright young stars are observed in 0.4 parsecs. And people surveyed the center of 1 parsec very thoroughly, and they found none between 0.4 and 1. Maybe there are some outside one parsec. It's still unknown, but there is almost none. I think it's perfectly none between 0.4 and 1 parsec.
Outside that ring.
Can you convert it to masses like between either 0.4, I've seen stars about this mass, and this distance, I don't see stars.
So in the ring,
K melted of 15 or brighter, so it turns it into mass of, we got probably 10, 20 or so masses.
And outside, the most massive stars will be
outside what?
Outside 0.4 parsec. There's almost no young bright stars. That's the.
But then you say nothing. It's some limit, right? So nothing
above the mass. Yeah. So that's K of 15 or brighter. So if it's very faint, then there might be.
Nothing that pops out of the background.
Just
Possibility is the star cluster formed very near to the galactic center. But I don't know. So, this is the number of stars as a function, pericenter distance of stars. The red curve shows the total number of stars, and green curve shows the mass of only more massive than 20 solar masses. So this figure shows massive stars are very concentrated on the galactic center.
What's the difference between the green and the blue?
Blue is expected number from this red line if the fraction of massive star is the same everywhere.
That's so how it's that line moves blue. Down.
Seems to be. Okay, now if you plotted the cumulative distribution of observed massive stars, as someone just said, it would rise and then become really flat at about 0.4 parsec.
So yeah, we have quite a few between 0.4 and 1.
Exactly. So that's the old story then. I mean, your scenario predicts most of these massive stars to have been left behind precisely where none are seen.
What happens if the cluster is on a slightly eccentric orbit?
That's what the simulations were. They were for an eccentric orbit. It doesn't change much. I mean, most of the time is still spent far away.
Yes, that's.
And that's where most of the time stripping occurs. And so that's.
The summary is, we performed three self-consistent n-body simulations of star clusters and their parent galaxies. So for this simulation, we have developed a new free and direct hybrid code. So we found that once an IMBH formed in the cluster, the one-to-one mean motion resonance carries stars to the galactic center. So, star cluster scenario may explain the observation of the galactic center. Thank you.
But to not stay on a negative note, I mean, I think it's very, very difficult to make this work to explain the S stars or any of the young stars in the central parsec. Yet, we know, we see star formation, we see star clusters. So all this dynamics that you're studying happens. It's probably not the way to explain the very young stars in the central parsec, but it may well be connected to a lot of other things that are still very interesting, including injecting intermediate mass black holes into galactic centers in general, which gives you very interesting predictions for gravitational wave sources, for example, and other things.
Mikola has looked at the S-star part of this, where he's taken an intermediate mass black hole with like 20 entrained stars and just let it fall into the central black hole. And what you get left is plausibly S-star type orbits. So that part is okay, if you can get that far. What you leave behind, I think, is a totally different issue.
Well, there's also, Tal Alexander has done a lot of work on connecting. I can't reproduce the story, but once you have young stars out in the outer ring at half a parsec, where we see them, from those to get things that will go in, the sort of less massive of those very massive stars originally in the ring that get scattered in, and then through various processes of resonant relaxation, will that become what we see in the inner cluster? I think that's very plausible. So the S stars is not so much the problem, I think. It's really how you get this, how you get star formation in this outer ring to begin with.
Do you think you can use your code for a large global cluster where people cannot actually do embedded simulations for? Direct summation in the core of the cluster.
Yeah, if possible.
Use the tree for the outer part of the cluster. Then.
Yeah.
What outer part?
Global cluster.
Yeah, but how far out would you switch to the tree code? Because TRH is already, there's two-body relaxation throughout most of the global cluster, right?
So when the star goes beyond the half-mass radius, then you treat it as a tree code, then. When it comes back, then.
A very, very long time ago, Pete Hutt, Jim McKeon, and I wrote a paper on this. You don't gain that much, because almost all the compute is in the core, if you're doing direct online.
Okay.
Yeah, if possible, but...
But you can still make the number of stars small, particles in your simulations.
Yeah, but it's difficult to treat binary. So it's a problem.
We didn't even consider that.
Any other questions?
Sorry? We should move on. We have two more
problems.
Yeah. Frank is interrupting.
It's only 1:30.
So short is sort of relevant. Relevant to the length of the day.
Exactly. I thought they weighed human.
Someone just start reducing the time.
Oops.
It must be an app on the iPhone.
To make it be where the microphone is. Being recorded.
I have a question about your password.
It's not too safe.
Is your cursor a binary star?
It wasn't on purpose. So, I'm going to present a family of self-consistent triaxial tidal models, which I hope can be relevant for global clusters. I'm Annalisa Barri, and I'm a graduate student at the Università degli Studi di Milano with my supervisor, Giuseppe Bertini. So, as an introduction, I will explain the motivation of this work, since the flattening of globular clusters do not seem to be still a major issue addressed in this conference and the recent papers. And I will recall very briefly some observational evidence of the deviation for sphericity for these systems. And then I will present the triaxial models with emphasis on the construction method and presenting also the intrinsic and projective properties of these models. So why do we have to worry, to care about the flattening of this object of globular cluster? Since it's commonly believed that the presence of the truncation radius for this system is due to the effect of the tidal field of the Hofstede galaxy, we do actually recognize that the spherical symmetry for this object is quite well, but zero-order approximation. So, in fact, if we consider that the cluster is not isolated, but it's inside the tidal field of the Hofstede galaxies, which is non-spherical, the resulting configuration should be non-spherical as well. And so we try to construct this self-consistent model in which the external tidal field is explicitly taken into account. But we also obviously have to use a very simple assumption for the orbit of the cluster. In fact, we use a circular orbit in order to have a static tide to be used in the construction of the equilibrium model. Obviously, the general case with no stationary guides associated to eccentric orbits is not suited to a description in terms of a simple analytical model, as we have done. So the main physical assumption about this system that we have made is that they are quasi-relaxed. I mean, this is justified in terms of the relevant timescales, in which for global cluster, the relevant relaxation time is shorter than the age of the clusters. So the two-star relaxation process should have enough time to bring the system close to a thermodynamical relaxed state. And so the distribution function should be close to a Maxwellian. And this is the base argument for the spherical key model traditionally used and widely accepted, I mean. For comparison, just we mentioned the elliptical galaxies, which have the opposite, completely opposite situation about the relevant time scales. And in fact, they are only partially relaxed stellar system, in which we have to use an isotropic pressure tensor in order to have a proper characterization of this system. In both cases, simple self-consistent stationary dynamical models, and with this statement I mean the equilibrium solution of the collisionless Boltzmann equation and the Poisson equation, can offer a simplified but I think still useful representation of this stellar system. So, if we think about what is the physical origin of the flattening of the globular cluster, we can use three arguments in order to explain that. The internal rotation to cause some anisotropy in this velocity space, or to use an external tidal field. Before you kill me about mentioning solid body rotation, I would like just to explain that when I think that should be expected by recalling the assumption of quasi-relaxation. I just mean that if we use a statistical mechanical argument about a relaxed system in rotation, if you use the argument about the extremization of the Boltzmann entropy, the only argument of the distribution function is A minus omega jz, which is the Jacobi integral and which require a solid body rotation. Obviously, the extremization process of the entropy requires the constraints on the constant energy, constant mass, and constant angular momentum. So I'm not talking about the comment about yesterday and the fact that the globular cluster move the angular momentum in the outer part and, in fact, the rest is spherical for this argument.
Get a rough idea, how much does this really matter? I mean, in a sense, like, how does the relaxation time of the globular cluster compare with the characteristic time scale over which the external tidal field changes significantly?
In the whole description that we are going to give, we assume that the dynamical time scale of the cluster is much smaller than the orbital time scale associated to the movement of the cluster inside the galaxy.
So
it's a perturbative approach, in fact, to what I'm going to address in the models.
So, sorry, I guess I interrupted you. The main conclusion is that what you're doing is sort of locally correct, pretty much, inside of the galaxy, even if the globular cluster is on some funny orbit, because...
Yes, yes, in fact, you're right. It's just to be honest and saying things. So, if you have to interpret object with non-monotonic rotation curve and non-monotonic ellipticity profile, you can obviously use a solid bodies hypothesis, but you have to require a differential internal rotation. And there are just few models, equilibrium models, I mean, that were proposed for using an interpretation of the flattening in terms of internal rotation. And these are a few references. And in fact, they are actually the most famous, probably, were initially presented for explaining the flattening of elliptical galaxies. If we consider the anisotropy in the velocity space, actually, this argument should be less relevant for quasi-relaxed stellar system as the globular cluster, while it is in effect considered as the primary cause of the flattening for the bright elliptical, and is usually interpreted as a signature of the deformation process in terms of violent relaxation. And also in this case, we can have some equilibrium model that can be derived in terms of statistical mechanics argument. And in the end, if we use the argument about the external tidal field, maybe this could be the natural expectation in terms of the previous consideration. And in fact, a few equilibrium models have been already proposed by Weinberg in 93 and Egger and Mamani in 95, which have the quite similar approach to the one I will present. So, in fact, our interpretation of the flattening of these objects is still rather patchy, as is pointed out in a recent paper by Vandenberg. And usually, the observed deviation from sphericity in the inner part of the object are interpreted as an effect of the internal rotation, as King previewed in 61, and while the outer part are thought to be flattened by the external tidal field. Since we have got such a great process in the acquisition of the detailed quantitative information about the structure and the kinematics of globular cluster in terms of proper motion and a lot of other quantitative information, can be relevant to make some new effort into the side of the modeling. And in fact, as a small reminder, to relax the assumption of the spherical symmetry can be maybe useful to interpret deeper the structure and the dynamics of the system, as was happened for the elliptical galaxies, to recognize the distinction between those systems that are rotationally supported from those that are anisotropy support, can be relevant in order to formulate the adequate formation scenarios or other questions. So the observational evidence for the flattening of globular clusters, there aren't so many, actually. And to be pointed out, as first, there are no uniformly accepted definition for the shape parameters. And with shape parameters, I mean the position angle and the ellipticity. In particular, the ellipticity have a lot of different definition about global definition or local referred to the half-light isophoto or something like that. So it can be quite difficult to compare different studies. But it's a fact that galactic globular clusters are rather round. This is the main paper that everybody used for the information about the ellipticity, which is quite old, actually, and is still the one used. And the problem is that, in fact, the values do not refer to a standard isophoto. So also some of the conclusion that they claimed are maybe not so sure due to this problem. And in fact, just few ellipticity profiles are measured also for the globular cluster. Geyer et al. 93 presented 20 globular clusters of the galaxy and 4 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So there are also other individual studies, but it's not really frequently addressed observational issue. And
so
So the lack of a correlation between position interval and galactic center does not mean anything, because it's not measured at the standard. So if you measure in the inner parts and the flattening is due to rotation, you do not expect. So, and if you measure for some, the external part, then you might expect, but in a situation where you're not doing this carefully, the lack of a correlation.
I'm not saying that this paper is not reliable completely. I'm just saying that it's not so reliable. Just that.
Very nice.
I mean, while for extragalactic globular cluster is also widely known that are more flattened in general for the Magellanic clouds than the one in globular for the galaxy. And actually, also in NGC 5128, when a few recent studies have been produced, while for M31, the distribution of ellipticity is quite similar to the one of the galaxies. So this is just a visual representation of what we have just said. And this is a typical ellipticity profile for an object this in M31. With a global tabulated value. This kind of value are measured as from the IRF task ellipse, I think. So they are a global measure of the ellipticity weighted on the elliptic annuli which are used to sample the image. So also the position angle is represented, and it's quite evident that these systems do not show twisting of the isophotes. I mean, in the terms of what is, can be seen. So let's start with the presentation of the models. And we used a very simple physical model in order to be tackled analytically, almost. And in fact, we used the assumption of spherical symmetry for the galaxy. And we used a circular orbit for the globular cluster. And we used a co-rotating frame of reference centered in the center of mass of the cluster. And we assume that the distance from the center of mass of the galaxy and the one of the cluster is much bigger than the extension of the cluster and also the mass. Within this kind of assumption, we can use the tidal approximation. And so the Jacobi integral is, in fact, available easily from the equation of motion of the stars inside the cluster. And we have the contribution from the tidal field, which has this expression, since the tidal approximation is linear in the field. And this one is, in fact, the contribution for the self-consistent generated potential from the cluster. And this numerical coefficient with here the epicyclic frequency associated to the chosen form of the galactic potential are, in fact, just a numerical constant. And these two reference values are corresponding to a logarithmic potential with a flat rotation curve, for which diffraction is one, is two actually, squared. So, okay. And the other one for the Keplerian point mass profile for the galaxy, so the ratio is one. For the distribution function, we decided to focus on the direct generalization of the spherical King models. But in principle, our approach can be used for generalizing every spherical isotropic truncated models. So we used the FKD, the usual one from the King models, in which we used the Jacobi integral instead of the energy of the single particle, with HO, which is the cutoff constant as for the spherical models, which is related to the chosen depth of this central potential well for the configuration. The associated density profile, as usual, is the one with the incomplete gamma function, and we use the notation rho hat to include in these two terms. And the psi, the small psi, is the dimensionless escape energy, in which, in fact, we'll use this. The total potential in the rotating co-rotating frame of reference. So since we are using the Jacobi integral, which is an isolating integral of motion, the collisionless Boltzmann equation is satisfied, and we can just proceed to solve the Poisson's equation. In fact, this family is characterized by two parameters, two physical scales as in the spherical model, King models, and two dimensional parameters, the one which is already available in the spherical case related to the concentration. And I'm using this notation instead of the usual one, I'm sorry. And the tidal strength, which is defined as the ratio of the orbital frequency, the square of the orbital frequency, over the one, the square of the natural frequency associated to the central density of the cluster. So for a given value of the psi, the capital psi of the central potential, there exists a maximum critical value for the tidal strength parameter, epsilon critical, and I'm going to explain this well in a few slides. And we are just considering a closed configuration as the model, which means subcritical model with the value of epsilon smaller than the critical one. In general, these models are characterized by few properties that can be also expected from the form of the tidal potential, which is quadratic in the coordinate, the local coordinate center in the center of the globular cluster. So the deformation is shaped by the tidal potential and depends on the numerical coefficient nu. So we've got a compression along the z-axis here, and an elongation along the x-axis, which is directed to the center of the galaxy. The natural coordinate plane is, in this frame of reference, are also symmetry planes for the configuration. And the boundary of the model are zero velocity surfaces, so they are equipotential surfaces for the total potential in the co-rotating system. So the critical models that I will mention here and there in the presentation are referred to the one where the boundary is the singular Hilbert surface for the configuration. But we, since we are referring also only to subcritical regimes, can also have the whole possibility of the inner Hilbert surfaces, the subcritical one. We are not treating the one opened, which are overcritical, since we have to have a consistency with the stationary hypothesis. We can use open surfaces, otherwise we will have escapers or something. And in fact, for all the models, the deformation is monotonically increasing with the distance from the center. These are.
What happens along the y-axis? Z is compression.
And is in fact is untouched by the perturbation because do not appear in the analytical form of the tidal field, and is it within this kind of scheme is rest equal to the what is predicted by the spherical King models. I'm going to show it in the results section. So the mathematical problem that we have to address is to solve, in fact, the Poisson's equation. In a proper dimensionless formulation using the standard R0 length scale, we have to write down the Poisson's equation, which can be used for value of psi greater than 0. And for the other domain where the psi is less than 0, we have, in fact, to refer to the Laplace equation, which is just appears like this because we are using the dimensionless formulation. So we've got two domains that are separated by a boundary surface defined by the condition psi equals 0, which is in fact boundary, but is unknown a priori. I mean, can be determined just at the end of the calculation process. And so formally, we can say that we have to solve a second-order partial differential equation in a free boundary problem formulated like this. And the relevant boundary condition for the Poisson's equation, that I will call in the other slide internal region, are the one referred in the origin and is the traditional one for the value of the depth of the potential well, and the condition for the gradient, because we are using three-dimensional coordinate. And in fact, for the boundary condition of the Laplace equation, we are using the standard vacuum condition for large radii. The idea initially was to formally solve the equation, one and the other one, and then patch the solution and their gradient in order to be continuous. In fact, this should determine the free constant that arises since we are just one boundary condition for the Laplace equation. Since it's a second-order problem, we have to have two and two conditions, but physically when
also you can just call for one. So we in fact use a perturbative approach in which the tidal effect is considered as a small perturbation acting on the configuration described by the spherical key models. And in fact, the requirement of epsilon to be small can be interpreted is equivalent to required that the dynamical time scale of the cluster is much smaller than the orbital time scale of the movement inside the Austin galaxy. And considering this approach, we can expand in an asymptotic series the psi, which is the function that we have to determine. in fact, the general term psi k of the series must also be expressed in terms of a spherical harmonic in order to have a much more easier to solve problem in one dimension with the radial one, just with the radial one Cauchy problems. In fact, using this approach, you have to realize that this perturbation problem is in fact singular, which means not that it's a problem in how is formulated the asymptotic expansion, but is in fact a problem of the existence of the series. I mean that the radius of the convergence of the series vanishes for r when is near to the truncation radius, which is the boundary of the spherical configuration, this king one. And in fact, which means the fact that the radius convergence vanish, it can be also said as the validity of the expansion breaks down when the first, that should be the leading terms, is of the order of epsilon. Since the psi 1 is not vanishing at the truncation radius, so it is no more leading term, the psi 0, which should be. And this problem can be solved by the introduction of an intermediate region between the internal and the external one, can be treated as a boundary layer. And we have to use not just a patch of the solution, but an asymptotic matching of the two distinct pairs, of the internal solution and the layer solution, and then the layer solution and the external one, using the Van Dyke prescription, which is much formally complicated than a simple patch. And this kind of problem actually also arises in the study of the rigidly rotating polytrope, and this is an old paper with a similar approach. And we in fact calculated the full explicit solution to two order in epsilon, and in fact the relevant partial differential equation for each order, psi 1 and psi 2, are reduced to a simple set of ordinary differential equation, for which we have to solve numerically just for the internal region, since the one of the solution in the boundary layer and in the external solution can be we can have them just to a formal expression, which is the one necessary to perform the match. I can give you all the details, I will be glad to, but I think that it's not the good moment during lunch. But if you want, I've got the slides. Otherwise, you can probably, can be enough to say that the first order solution is characterized by just the harmonics with 0, L, 0, and 2, and the corresponding value of M greater than 0 and even. We are using the radial spherical harmonic with the standard orthonormalization. Normalization. And for the second order solution, the harmonics are the relevant one are just 0, 2, and 4, and the corresponding value. Actually, we demonstrated by induction that for the kth order solution terms, the relevant one are just this one with 2k, so 1, 2, and 2, 4. So the parameter space of these models, as I've already mentioned, there are just two dimensional parameters, the psi, which is related to the concentration, and epsilon, which is related to the effect of the tidal field, which can be interpreted in terms of the relevant radii of this configuration, which are the scale radius, the truncation radius, which is the one for the spherical associated configuration, and the tidal, or usually said the Jacobi radius, which is the one associated to the critical boundary, the critical surface that could or could not be the boundary of the model. It depends on the value of epsilon. So if you are a fixed value of psi and of epsilon, you can recover the value of the corresponding Jacobi radius of the associated critical surface just by this condition that can be demonstrated being sufficient instead of using the wall gradient condition for finding the singular point of the surface. And if you use a zero-order approximation, which means just the monopole term for the phi c, which is the contribution from the potential of the cluster, you recover the usual expression for the Jacobi radius, where from Spitzer or something. I mean, it's usual known in these terms. Alternatively, instead of using psi and epsilon, you can use c, as is usually defined as the concentration parameter, and it's just a matter of choice to use air truncation or the effectively radius where the triaxial system goes to zero. We decided to conserve this kind of definition. And also the extension parameter, which is, I've listened sometimes that is called the filling factor, but in fact it's just a way to measure how are deformed the final configuration. And for finding the proper value for the critical condition, so no fixed epsilon is just fixed psi, you have to solve numerically these two equation problem as in system where the unknown are Rj and epsilon critical in order to decide this solution can provide the value of the critical epsilon. And it's all, if you are using the zero order approximation, the corresponding extension parameter in the critical case is the famous two-third that is usually up here. So the results, the intrinsic density profile of the models. Here I'm presenting second-order model with value of psi from 1 to 10, and so they are critical, and the value is the corresponding one. And nu equals equal 3, which is called for the Keplerian galaxy. So 1 to 10. And this one, for the top panel, the red curve corresponds to the triaxial model along the x-axis, since they are intrinsic. And the black one is the corresponding King model of the same concentration. While for the bottom, we have got the red is the epsilon axis, the y axis, and for black, the z-axis contribution. So the this kind of profile is more extended than the corresponding King models, while the profile on the z-axis is a little bit less, and the y-axis is almost the same as the King model. For the projected density and velocity dispersion profile, we actually explored a 10 non-trivial line of sight, but here I'm presenting just the one where it is used the y-axis. We know, since it's the most favorable line of sight to evaluate the flattening. I have the same models as the previous plot. And this is the projected density profile. The distinction is still available. You can still see that are different. And for the velocity dispersion profile, there are also some differences. And here is plotted actually just the models along the x-axis. And the deviation from sphericity, we analyzed the ellipticity profile for the projected image of all the models that we calculated. Here I'm presenting just psi equal 2, 4, 6, and 8. And they are monotonically increasing function of the major axis. And in fact, as expected, the flattening is not so relevant. I mean, we can construct just a configuration with a moderate flattening, which is quite comforting, since the value of the ellipticity measured in the real object are not so big. So, and the other plot is the axis ratio of the inertial ellipsoid of the critical second-order model, which is just a way to give global information about the deviation from the sphericity of the model. And as you can see, these are still critical models, but there is a dependence on the value of the concentration. So just the low psi critical model shows a relevant deviation from simplicity, while the other one, the eigen concentration regimes, are not so flattened.
Is that the semi-neutral axis normalized to the co-radius?
Yes, still.
So does this sudden increase in the eccentricity occur at the same fraction of the, say, Jacobi radius?
Mm-hmm.
You can normalize that by the Jacobi radius. Is that the onset of eccentricity occur at the same, more or less at the same?
Yes, I think so. So is my conclusion. The models that I presented are, in fact, a self-consistent solution in which the external tides are explicitly incorporated. And in the absence of the tidal field, they reduce to spherical key models. In fact, this mathematical approach can be used also to extend other isotropic truncated models. And we done the calculation for the polytropes of index low order index. And the extension of the spherical key models can be also performed to the case of the internal rotation for the solid body case with the same mathematical approach. And for future development, maybe these models can be useful for constructing the initial condition of n-body simulation for tidally perturbed cluster for also the underfield regime, since we can model also this kind of configuration. And we would like to perform some few comparisons with the observation, keeping in mind always that we are having this heavy absorption of the circular orbit of the cluster. And in fact, the problem of the extratidal light, the structure on the surface brightness profile that extend beyond what is prescribed by the spherical key models, can be maybe interpreted in terms of these models. And in general, they can maybe be relevant for the discussion about the correct definition of the truncation radius and the Jacobi radius.
So this is beautiful. It's the Roche problem for collisionless systems, right, basically. It's amazing that somebody like Chandrasekhar hasn't done this in a long time. I assume you looked. But
yes. No, actually.
There's no discussion of, because, I mean, going back a century, it was incompressible fluids.
Mm-hmm.
And it was redone many times. And Chandra did some work on, I actually did some work many years ago on the polytropic case.
Yes.
Somebody must have thought about doing it for collisionless matter.
Yes, the first was presented by Hegi Ramani, but their solution is not in terms of analytical discussion in these terms. They just use a decomposition on the spherical harmonic, and they set up a numerical calculation in order to have the exact value of epsilon. So they are just presenting the critical models. We can call first them order. Critical. And first order, yes, just the first one. While the calculation can be extended for every order in principle. So.
But the comparison with observations, did I hear at the beginning you said the observed position angles don't seem to know anything about the galactic center? Isn't that a big
Is that
problem?
Big problem, yes. In
but
fact,
how do you get that?
What? I mean, eventually,
but she was pointing out that the
is not
happening is measured at different distances from the center.
It's not so reliable, I hope.
If the inner parts are flattened by rotation, they have nothing to do with the galactic tidal field, then it's not supposed to be aligned with the or pointing toward the galactic center.
I mean, if the ellipticity that are published and known are effectively referred just to the internal region of the cluster, I can explain with this kind of model because the ellipticity profile is almost circular in the inner region. But if there is some room for a measurement in the external part, I think that can be used for a comparison.
There is a continuous stream of stars in the L2 and 3. It would be quite difficult for you to compare your result with actual observations because you don't know which one is inside the tidal, which are curated and which are outside. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to compare that with ambient simulations.
That's exactly the point of what are extra tidal light. In fact, they are part of the bounded configuration or they are already part of the tidal stream. Van der Marel and McLaughlin pointed out that it's a little bit too usual for the recent interpretation of this surface brightness profile to be just some episode of tidal streams which are unbounded stars. And that's why they started to use the Wilson sphere, which are more extended than the spherical King models, in order to be able to interpret properly this kind of phenomena.
In the LMC, the young clusters tend to be quite flat compared to galactic level clusters, and even compared to some of the older clusters in the LMC. So those clusters that are flat, they tend to be younger than their relaxation time. Mm. So one explanation for that flatness, different from the one you're talking about here, would be that it's not rotation, it's not tidal effects, but it's the fact that the velocity distribution function is anisotropic, and it's supporting the cluster along different axes by having different pressures.
As in the
same way, the elliptical galaxies are held up by different mounts in different directions.
Why can it not be rotation?
No, I'm just saying this is one possibility. When you look at the stage sequence, you see that the older ones are rounder. So in this case, when they're younger than the relaxation time, you don't have a constraint on anyone. You have any of these three possible explanations. And what would happen there, so I think what could happen in the case, so let's think about the life sequence of a cluster using the LMC clusters as a sort of clue for how things happen in the early stages. The cluster may actually not have an isotropic velocity distribution function in the stars. There's no particular reason it should.
Right.
It's formed in a very turbulent, the stars are formed in a very turbulent medium. And then, as it begins to relax, what will happen is the velocity distribution will become more isotropized. It'll become more an approximation to your models. Mm-hmm. Then the only two options are rotation and tidal effects. But at the beginning, we have this third option. Mm-hmm. And so it could be, I'm not saying it's been demonstrated, it could be that the clusters are flatter, young clusters are flatter when they form, partly because of this additional effect, which then goes away with age.
Thank you.
The mist should get at the beginning of the options was there. Of course, you have to imagine a story like this of evolution, that the three options should be tested, in my view, separately.
And the fact that the age sequence tends to show you that the clusters get rounder with age suggests, is very suggestive to me anyway, that maybe this anisotropy thing is part of the explanation, especially when you see the biggest effect for clusters that are younger than one of their own relaxation.
Okay.
Thank you. So the first thing, the quasar that we discussed at the coffee, I did get the image from SDSS. It's not this thing, it's not that thing. It's this little teeny tiny dot, which if, again, I've not done much with SDSS data, that's about consistent with the PSF, if I'm thinking about it correctly. So if you want to know the structure of this galaxy, good luck. So I actually, my talk is about the observed structure. And why would you even bother caring about this for extragalactic globular clusters? So the problem is that HST can actually resolve these things, so you can no longer treat them as just point sources, just fit PSF to them, because if you ignored the structure, then your photometry is probably going to be biased in some way. The other thing is that the Milky Way only has about 150 clusters that we can look at, so if we go to a different galaxy with, you know, an order of magnitude more clusters, you can look at the trends between the structure parameters a lot better. It's also kind of interesting, is the structure universal? Do elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies have the same cluster structure because, you know, they're different potentials that they're orbiting in? That's not necessarily given. And then you can look at other things that the structure, you can look at features that somehow maybe depend on the structure, like these low-mass X-ray binaries. This would be the point where I would insert my data slide, but I forgot my data slide. If you weren't here for the talks at the conference 2 weeks ago, this is HST ACS data. It's a single pointing of the center of M87. It's 50 orbits split into V and I data. The I data, which is what I've used to do at least fits, is about 74,000 seconds. So that's just a quick summary of what the data is. So we fit King models using the King 1966 thing. And it's the reason to do this is it's not a bad first guess estimate of what the structure for the clusters looks like. It also has parameters that are fairly well defined. People can kind of agree that these are, you know, the core radius is defined using this equation. The tidal radius is defined by the point where the density of the cluster goes to zero. And then the concentration is just the ratio of the two.
But Chris, do you really think that the core radius is well defined? I mean, because observationally, it's really hard to determine that. Right?
Yes. I will get to how hard it is to determine the core. But if you just define King 66 models with this is defined as the core for that model, then it's you have a consistent definition for in this, I guess, modeling procedure.
It's very well defined.
Yes. Observationally, it's not, but...
So this is going to be a recurrent theme this week, I suspect. I guess a more general way to ask the question is, your data constrain which part of the King profile best?
Okay.
I guess it's typically neither the core nor the tidal radius.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in between is where, presumably somewhere around a half-light radius, is where all the signal is really.
I have a slide for that.
It's kind of strange that you fit, you know, you end up expressing things in terms of two quantities that correspond to places where your data are the least formative, right?
If we had a better model to fit, we probably would have fit the better model. So.
But then if you don't have data, you cannot say it. I mean, you need some theoretical reason. If your data are all in a range where King model fit well, if you have data extending to larger other parts, then you can start distinguishing between King model and something else. Or in data, if you have only data around half mass radius and twice half mass radius, you are stuck.
Well,
whatever you like.
Let me try to think here. I don't remember. And for this fit, I think everyone would agree that this is a pretty decent fit to the actual data. So this dashed line here is the tidal radius that we've come up with, which you could argue that maybe the tidal radius should have fallen here somewhere, but this isn't a bad estimate of tidal radius. The core radius is, of course, I don't remember exactly, but it's probably somewhere in here. It's a log scale, so it's less than the first pixel. Again, I should have looked up what the half-mass radius on this one is, but it's somewhere in this range. So constraining any of these things directly is kind of hard. But if you assume this thing has to be fit with a King model and that this is the best fitting King model, these are the radii, these are the parameters that are the best fit model. So again, the discussion of you can use some of these more complicated models. So this is, I believe, Dean McLaughlin's paper from 2006, where it's King models, Wilson models. I think this is a Sirsak profile. And basically, the argument is that this little deviation here shows that the King model doesn't really fit the outer extents very, very well. The issue is that this is, you know, many orders of magnitude down from the peak, from the central surface brightness. So at the level of the data that we have, resolving this kind of a difference reliably in the noise of the background is basically impossible. So that's why we don't use these Wilson models or anything more complicated than just a simple King model.
Wait, Chris, can you explain what the different curves are? There's like a dash curve, a dot dash curve.
Oh, golly. Okay, so the red line for each of these is the model that's the best fit of whichever of these models. So each row is a single cluster in their sample. This is the PSF, if I'm not mistaken, or something like the PSF for each.
So it's basically not relevant. So the red line is the fit.
The red line is the actual fit. Yeah, sorry.
Well, it's very relevant. It's the PSF.
Well, not for what he's describing.
Well, then
it
tells you how well you're actually resolving some of these.
Is background level one of your feeding parameters, or do you have it as from the control plane or something?
We'll get to that. This is not my data. This is the Dean McLaughlin paper. So I think this vertical line represents where they don't believe the data anymore because it's consistent with the background level. But that's not mine. So here's the actual, how is the fitting done? You convolve you lay out the King model on an image, convolve it with the PSF, calculate the chi-squared match to the actual data, and then repeat and find the best model. And we want to find the best concentration, tidal radius, the centering is important, you need to have the total cluster flux, and the background level as well. So we actually do fit that. And these are just the numbers. We have 21 total clusters, of which 1,600 we actually believe the results that come out. And so this is the subtracted residual image of subtracting off the cluster. And this is the profile. So here's the what actually happens, how well things can be believed. First thing you have to do is find the center, which should be easy. Depending on how the PSF has been sampled, that may not be the case. Once you found the center, you fit kind of a toy model that kind of looks decent. And then you take all of the stuff that isn't the cluster and fit a background level to that. Once you have that background level, that tells you what the flux is because it's, you know, whatever's inside. Where the data become consistent with that background is where you set the tidal radius. And then it's kind of hard to show on here, but you'd use all of the data between that tidal radius and the center to constrain the shape of the King model that you use. So I'm pausing here for questions.
So the actual tidal radius is going to be slightly beyond that because you're seeing projected background.
Actually, I have a more general question. Why should the tidal radius have anything to do with that place where you run into the background?
If you want to measure it, if you've messed up your background, and say you've messed up your background too high, then you're only looking at kind of a central portion of the cluster. So that gives you a smaller tidal radius, which gives you a, less concentrated model.
I understand that what you define to be the tidal radius that way will move.
Yeah.
In the way you said, but
we want to know how do I believe this
is having a meaning, you know, like what she was talking about.
Well,
I don't see any relationship at all between the version of the tidal radius and what you just defined.
This is the point where the background level is effectively the same as whatever model we're trying to fit. So it's basically where the model goes to zero.
Yeah, and the models.
So it's the dense. It's the dense. The density of the model at this purple line is zero.
Yeah. So it's a truncation.
Yeah.
Yes. It's possible, yes, that you can have this extend out much larger, but.
So you're saying that
there's no, you'd never be able to constrain something like that?
The local density of your king model at the edge is the background density. It's not. It's that of, you are defining the edge of your king model.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I will rephrase in some other way.
Okay. We can talk. It's also in, it's not a background, it's the background level of the galaxy light that we're measuring. So, again, trying to convert things into densities is unclear. But this is actually how the code works. And as far as I can figure, this is how all similarly done codes do the same thing. So these are all the problems that you'd have with this.
Hold on, wait, you didn't finish this. So you have a fixed RT. You are left then with one parameter you adjust to.
And yeah, so we change W.
Concentration.
Yeah, you change the concentration until it gets consistent with the inner points.
Isn't what you do for all your clusters around galaxies?
In the
only,
well.
I thought RT was a derived quantum.
Right, well, that's because you're looking. Yeah, I mean, if you were doing this, this is, you know. If you're looking at this from the ground, yeah. If you're looking at this from the ground, you'd probably be looking, something here.
I mean, the real problem is that you're only measuring one scale, and you have two free parameters. You just don't have enough. I mean, fundamentally, all you can measure is the width of that blob there. That's one scale.
But you can also measure the slope of that. Across here, the tidal radius on this one is something like 30 pixels.
Yeah,
so there's something inside this circle. There's something like 900-ish.
Yeah, it's not just.
And well, I guess more than that. It's 60 squared. So.
But can't you fit a king model to the shape without having to make assumptions? I guess the problem is that you don't.
The point is that you don't constrain it in any way, because if you don't fit a background, then you always want to fit something that's super highly concentrated. That's because if you take a FITS image and run it through DS9 to get an actual image out, DS9 does a really weird compression thing, which is why it looks all blocky. And I have not figured out a good way to fix that.
So here, can I ask a theoretical question? So
okay.
Say you were looking at some galaxy, right? And you had two clusters. Say I just gave you some synthetic data.
Okay.
And I had two clusters that had the exact same tidal radius,
yes,
and same concentration, but one was just much more massive. So it seems like your algorithm would actually say that the more massive one has a larger tidal radius.
Mm.
Right, because...
If you simulated... Okay, I see. You're saying because of the noise level.
Background is further out.
I think the answer is no, because king models fall off fast enough. King models fall off.
Well, they fall off fast once you.
Oh, so you're saying it's going to be a small difference.
You can test this, right? Take a king model and generate fake data.
Let's just go through, and when we get to that slide, we'll get to that slide. So PSFs are important. If you get the PSF wrong, you're sunk. Parameter space is also degenerate. This is the thing where if you get the background wrong, you can get a really nice model that doesn't have anything to do with the actual system. This is the Carlson and Holtzman paper that Aronov talked about. They suggest that you need something like a signal to noise of 500 integrated across the entire cluster that you're trying to fit to get any good results. So why should you trust the fits? So if you put in a simulated cluster on a background noise that's, this is a little bit low, but the signal to noise actually matches pretty well for this. And then run through the code, do you get out what you put in? So the model we put in is, just for this example here, is a W of 9.2, RT of about 30, and about 20th magnitude at M87 distance, which is a fairly bright cluster. There's no residual, and you get out effectively the same parameters you put in. And this one I chose based off of the previous example that I showed that was the actual cluster. These are roughly the parameters for that cluster.
So if you, so back to my question, if you try this with different magnitudes, with same W dot, is that the thing?
All right. So these are what everyone wants to know. If you put in a bunch of clusters with a bunch of different parameters, but it's a six-parameter space, and we fill five of those and then just do a couple testings on background level, because hopefully you can estimate the background pretty well. we're good to within a teeny tiny bit of a pixel. These are the distribution functions. And again, so this is, you know, 0.02 of a pixel. So it does the center well. Photometry, it does the background to within 2 counts or so, which these are something, you know, they have thousands and thousands of counts for each cluster. The magnitude is pretty accurate to about 0.05 of magnitude. And this is for the magnitude limit that we've set, which is everything brighter than 25th magnitude. This is consistent with that Carlson-Holtzman signal-to-noise constraint. So here's the, if you put in things, this is the summation over all magnitudes that we trust. And this is the error in tidal radius. This is the error in the W-naught parameter. So this is kind of what you're asking. If you put in all of these different things with the various parameters, does the, as long as you're above this critical signal-to-noise, you get out what you put in. And kind of this broadening is things kind of at the edge of this, or things, if you're very highly concentrated, RT is poorly defined. If you're very, very small in RT, W is hard to define. So there's kind of these two things couple, and I can actually, you can actually plot this up, and there's a nice ellipse where they correlate together. So you could say, but you've just simulated data that doesn't actually mean anything. So Mark Peacock, who is here for the conference, has actually run using my code on M31 globular clusters using this SwiftCam, which is a ground-based IR thing, which is kind of about the same signal noise and pixel scale as the HST data is for M87. And he compared to Pauline Barmby's HST fits. And this is, let's see here. This is RT, input and output. This is RH, and this is RC. So they set their cutoff limit at 15th magnitude in K, which I did a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation yesterday, corresponds to about the same I magnitude of 25 that I'm calling for MA7. And so basically the scatter that they find is, it's not actually listed in the paper, but just by I, it's, you know, they're pretty good to within a factor of 2 for all of these parameters. So this didn't show very well. You can actually start comparing all of our structure, measured structure, to Milky Way structure. Do they distribute in the same way? So this is the half-light radius. The red is my M87 data. The green, which hopefully people can actually see here, is 10 times the Milky Way distribution, just to get them on the same scale. And the peaks are in the same place. This scatters more, but it's Poisson statistics for the Milky Way. So it kind of, I mean, they're basically the same. I haven't done a chaos test or something yet, because this is things that we're going to do next week. So the next thing to do is look at, as a function of the absolute magnitude of the cluster, the core radius. And again, it kind of, I haven't done any tests yet, but they fall in the same location. There's not, you know, large skew in any fashion, which is, again, a good idea that maybe we're probably getting things no worse than the Milky Way. But these things up here are possibly these UCD, dwarf spheroidal, things that are really, really bright and are bigger than a globular cluster. So we haven't, there's no good definition for what this, for what makes a globular cluster not a UCD or things like this. So we haven't done any cuts at that point. So this is the absolute magnitude. So mass and luminosity increase towards the right. And this is the log 10 of the core radius in parsecs. And so this is basically 1 parsec. This is 10th of a parsec and 10 parsecs.
And in the increasing core radius there for those very massive objects.
These things here?
Yes. Could not be a manifestation of what John was thinking about more massive objects, you think, bigger, larger size, and then that's what John was thinking.
It could be. I'm going to say I don't believe it is because of the simulation tests. I think if it's bright, I should. It's possible. I will definitely check that before I actually write the paper. Again, this is stuff I was going to do next week and write that paper, but scheduling. So, So this is, if we look at the concentration, again, this is the same absolute magnitude. This is concentration. And again, we basically track the Milky Way distribution, which in some fashion is kind of reassuring.
So does your fitting give you any characterization of whether the King model was a good fit? In other words, you find the best model, you find the best position.
Yes, we find the best. Unfortunately, the chi-squared parameter that would hopefully tell you, is this, compare these two clusters, is this cluster a better King model than this one, is not actually useful for that. If you have any companions, any companion clusters in the same field, then the chi-squared shoots up really, really high with no relation to the actual cluster fit. This is something I could probably work through and come up with a better algorithm to test that, but as of right now, I don't have a good way to tell you whether or not the K model was.
So the alternative model that people have opposed to this one, the outside function, those are two parameter models? Or it's complicated as the K model?
They're in general more complicated, if I remember them correctly. And because for the K model, you just have where does it stop and how quickly does it get there, kind of. These have a how quickly do they get there and then how much does this deviate from a K model in some fashion. So it has to be at least one more parameter to do something like that.
If you put those initial data, Milky Way co-collapse global cluster, what do you get as a result in the output? I mean, so
simulated.
Actually, can you get the co-collapse clusters from other galaxies?
I don't know. If you gave me a profile for a co-collapse cluster, I haven't looked at it. I could sit down and simulate this and do it.
Instead of using
The point is, all of these X's on the very, very top here, those are the ones labeled as core collapsed in the Harris catalog.
So if you took one of those, the observed profile from the Milky Way, and you stuck it in to do a simulation like you did with King models, your code would spit out some.
It would come up with some fit.
Would they actually be pretty high?
They should have high concentration. My cutoff on concentration is actually higher than this, but.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so in the red dots there's a line somewhere near the top, where basically everything above the top could be things that if they were closer, we would probably call core collapsed.
Yes.
The question is, where is that line? You can tell that by doing this.
I do not know right now. I could run these simulations and see. And that would probably take, if the profiles are easy enough to handle, it would probably take about a day or two to run through.
Well, I wouldn't use any model. I would just take an observed profile from some prototypical quote-unquote core collapsed cluster in the Milky Way. Use that as input. Just put it further away, effectively, with your background and see what comes up.
Again, it's not hard to do, but I've just not.
Because that would actually give you an estimate of what fraction of clusters in M87 could be core collapsed.
Yes.
If that were anywhere near the fraction of the Milky Way, it would be a very interesting result.
I'll have to look in.
You're just going to end up fitting a King model with the point spread function.
Well, I mean, that's the point. There's a point where if you get too centrally concentrated, everything's the same because it's all the lights in the PSF.
So what's the concentration of the PSF? The key model.
No, but it doesn't work that way because you still have lights and a resolved profile further out. So it's not that you have more information.
It depends on how sharp that. The turn.
No, what he's saying is would apply if the entire cluster were within the PSF.
But if the slope of the core collapse, basically if the slope of the just fit a power law to the core collapse cluster, if that slope is too high, then too large of a percentage of your light is in that central PSF or that central pixel. So then you're fitting the PSF because any of this, all this stuff that's outside of that central pixel is so many orders of magnitude lower than the PSF at that point that it doesn't contribute anymore. So, again, this is why getting the PSF correct. I just quickly went through it because I'm hungry. So here's the, if you wanted to know what the elongation is, This is just a picture of my blackboard, because when they came in to discuss this, I thought about it, and then the next day I drew this picture on the board. So this is M87. I've chosen the worst possible place to look for this elongation, because the average line of sight, or the average cluster that I'm observing, is located in this box with a radius that points along the line of sight. So any elongation that we'd see is not visible. So this also basically says, since we're looking through all of the cluster, or all of the galaxy, trying to get any radius dependence is a little bit tricky, because it's involved with this projection effect. So the only one that I've actually considered probably reasonable enough to show is this is the tidal density as a function of the projected radius from the center of the cluster. And it drops, which is what you'd expect, and whether or not this drop is exactly what you'd expect from, you know, the tidal radius being constrained by the galaxy mass is, again, this projection issue, which I haven't thought through far enough to believe I can resolve. So this is the it's my favorite mass to light ratio for each cluster times the total luminosity of the cluster divided by my measured tidal radius cubed with the, what is it, 4/3 pi in there. So it's the tidal density that you would expect if you just took all the light and the volume that is the cluster from my measured things.
What's the kiloparsecs?
This is parsecs, so that's 2, 4, and this is 10. This is 10 kiloparsecs.
Did it see? Yes.
Yeah.
I can do the conversion.
Okay. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't see that.
Yeah. So then the next thing is, if we have the structure that I believe, can we do anything about the LMXBs? And is this gamma a better predictor of which things host an LMXB than the mass? So if we just plot up the total luminosity, or absolute magnitude, which is a good proxy for mass, and this gamma parameter, you see that all of these X's, which are the clusters that have LMXBs, kind of fall at this bright end, and then there's these down here, which you'd say, oh, but those are on the top half of this gamma function, so all of these all these LMXBs in low mass clusters clearly show this gamma dependence. Then I'd show you this slide, which is a bit harder to tell, but this is color. All of those low mass LMXBs also fall in high metallicity clusters. So whether or not it's a gamma effect or a metallicity effect isn't clear here, because again, it's about a week before I was going to do the statistics to tell you what the answer is.
There's a Z dependence from the Jordan paper.
Yes. Yes, Aronov has a paper that says the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's known, but basically no one has good gammas, is I think the main problem, which is why people don't believe either one way or the other. So the plan is to put in, you know, here's all these data points, here are the possible dependence factors, what is the best dependence for, you know, Z, RC, M, I think that's it. I think those are the only parameters you have to worry about.
The low mass middle reach global clusters which have LMXBs, are they located close to the center? How highly likely that they be strongly highly stripped?
That's a good question. I'd write that down if I had the paper. I can tell you afterwards. It's just a matter, I just had to replot it. But that's a good point to consider.
Does it affect you at all, or does it bother you at all that you have this dependence on RC squared? Most of the LMXBs are likely to be in fairly high central density clusters, which may also be the ones where RC is the least well determined.
So your question is there a observational bias against?
The most interesting part of the gamma story is where you measure things with the greatest difficulty.
So it's basically the top half up here, is I guess the what you're asking about?
The
highest concentration clusters. I think the answer is, I don't think there's any reason that we wouldn't believe that, to believe these measurements. And it's probably something I should look into before claiming that this actually just depends on mass more so than gamma. But so then the conclusions, should you actually trust any observed structural parameters? And the answer is maybe. If you've ever used the Harris catalog and haven't read this, which is the bibliography and references, you should go right now and read this, and that maybe will explain why some people don't trust the Harris catalog that much. Do you trust my structural parameters? Well, of course the answer is yes. And this is as long as you believe the fact, if you assume that they're all spherical and that they're all reasonably well fit by a King model, then what I've done is at least consistent with all the measurements done before, because my data matches what the Milky Way says for all of these things, which shouldn't depend much on the structure. And it also says, since I match the Milky Way in this nice way, we can claim that the structure is probably somewhat universal, such that, you know, higher mass clusters are more concentrated. And again, it's kind of one of these things that's in the plot. So that's the end of my talk, I think. Yes.
All the parameters you measure, which are the ones you trust the most and the ones that we should not use? Or are they all equally reliable?
The position is perfectly reliable. I'll give you that.
Sorry?
The position? I know the position. That's very well defined.
I mean the structural parameters.
The structural parameters are a little bit... The point is everything else is dependent on each other. This is the degeneracy. If the background's wrong, then the tidal radius is wrong. The flux is wrong, which means it fits the wrong concentration.
We believe everything or we don't believe.
I mean, the point is the background is pretty well defined. It's hard to screw up the background on an image that's, you know, this thing's 30, this is 128 pixels. That's, you know, four times, so it's 16 times larger than the actual cluster. It'd be hard to get the background consistently wrong. So the background's safe, which means that the flux has to be safe, because once you have a background level, you just sum up everything inside. Tidal radius probably is the errors that I showed of, you know, plus or minus 2 pixels is probably, and 2 pixels corresponds to 4 parsecs or something, 5 parsecs, if I'm doing the math right. That's probably not totally correct. It's probably larger than that, but not excessively so. The core, I'm going to say that I believe the core is because I don't actually fit the core. I fit this shape, and because of the shape, but then again, this falls down into the very highly concentrated models. As you get to a super high concentration, so something more concentrated than 2, if even if this thing has a tidal radius the size of the actual image, then the core radius is smaller than a pixel still. So trying to constrain that, the point is, this is John's point that he made at the very beginning, you never ever measure the core in these extragalactic clusters. Even if you could resolve it, there's going to be PSF effects that you're going to have to be concerned with. And so I guess the core is the thing I believe the least, but I would like to tell you that I can believe the concentration and the tidal radius, so...
So, if you have
the
half mass radius, which I guess you do believe,
the point is I don't actually measure a half light radius. I measure, you know, the King model, and then I just derive.
That's exactly what I don't understand. Rather than passing everything through this assumed King model, and therefore making everything dependent on the assumption, which a lot of people will tell you is probably not so great, why not at least measure and catalog and report the one quantity you can actually measure directly well in a sort of model-independent way, which is the half-life radius?
Well, it's not, because it's a convolution with PSF.
Yeah.
So you don't know that.
Well, if the half-life radius is resolved by the observations, that's the one thing you measure.
So, again, this is something that
Or am I missing something?
I'll look into it and see.
The total excess.
What I'll just do.
Excess light on top of your background is well defined.
Just choose a handful of these clusters and just measure a half-light radius in some independent fashion, and see how well that matches. And if it matches well enough for kind of a randomly determined set.
You mean match what you would have inferred from the cube?
My inferred half-light radius from the actual measured one. Then if I do that, if those match, we're done. There's not a large enough thing to worry about.
That would be great.
So the idea that threads is to use the half-mass, the measured half-mass.
Well, it'd be the half
constraint.
Yeah, it'd be the half-light, and then yes. As long as that matches well with the actual cluster and inferred radius, half-light radius. Then that tells you something about how well that king model fit would work.
Instead of either radius and shape, you could use half mass radius and shape.
The reason I don't is because the tidal radius is easy to define for my king models, whereas the half light or half mass, I'd have to lay it out and do an integration and or interpolate on some grid or something.
So Chris, from your
I was just going to say it's almost been said already. I think the two numbers that you probably can determine that are the total luminosity of the cluster and the radius contained in the half light. And you could do that since you measure the total light, you subtract off the background, integrate under, you get the total light. I have a feeling that's probably very well known. So then you can.
That's very what?
I have a feeling that's probably very certain.
Very well determined by the data.
I'd have to. The issue of getting the convolution with the PSF correct. It's not just an issue of just expand out a annulus or a circle until you've been close to half light. But the point is, I think I could probably write a program that would do that without much trouble.
Right. So you have a total light, and then you do what Fred suggests, and you could go out to the radius, but you have to do this deconvolution first. Then you go to the radius that contains half the light, and I bet that would turn out to be a fairly well-determined parameter as well.
Yes.
I'm not willing to bet that.
And then the point is that as long as my K model fit matches that.
Exactly. So I think that the RH, in fact, I've done this with some data in the LFC, and so I know the answer in some cases, that when you do these K model fits, the core radius is uncertain and the tidal radius is uncertain. And so there's a family of models that works, each of which has a half mass radius. But those half-mass radii are almost all the same for all the king models that actually fit the data fairly well.
Yeah.
So I think if you go out and you do this measurement of the radius containing half the light in this model-independent way, and then you look at all the king models that would fit any one of your profiles, each one will have a half-mass radius. I think you'll find a small scattering of those and a very good gradient with this directly inferred half-light radius. And then the main uncertainties will be in the tidal radius and the core radius. I'm pretty sure that many people have done this, and this is what they found.
Yeah,
I think Michael did this in his paper. Many people have done it with clusters in the LFC. And I think the lesson is almost always that the half-mass radius that you infer from the models is very close to the half-light radius. Once you multiply through, there's a four-thirds factor you have to multiply for two dimensions versus three dimensions, and things like that. But once you do all that, I think you'll find that basically the half mass or the half light radius and the total luminosity are well known parameters.
So on the where I make this magnitude cut of everything has to be brighter than 25th magnitude, I can actually extend that about a magnitude and a half deeper if I ignore everything and just worry about the half light. Because again, it's the same issue that if I fit badly, I don't fit so badly that I get a half light radius that is significantly different than the input.
Radius is sort of the pivot point in those profiles. In other words, you can wag the small radius and the large radius.
So when I was actually,
but they all have to pivot around the best determined part of your data, which is right about the half-mass.
So when I was doing the simulations, this was I looked at all of the various parameters that I put in, got out, and so the point is the half mass and the half light radius. Even if I get it, if W is wrong and RT is wrong, they're both wrong in the correct way to make sure that the scatter in half light radius is pretty small. And then there's again a different cutoff where everything's just nonsense. So.
I know people need copies, but just a quick question. So back to your correlations between light.
Oh golly.
One second. So all these correlations you plotted with X-ray coincidence and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
Do you have any sense of how big the error bars are? Because you have a good idea, I think. Of
error bars on which things?
The dots that are plotted. So like gamma?
The error on gamma, I'm going to argue on this plot, is probably smaller than the symbol for everything bigger than this because it's logarithmic scale.
Really? Okay.
So we're not that, and we're not bad by it.
Okay. I guess I misunderstood that.
I missed the point here, by the way. Were you saying gamma is predicting better than mass?
I don't think gamma is predicting better than mass. I think metallicity and mass will solve the problem in the long run. Again, I haven't actually sat down to prove it using statistics and math, but this is a plot that I made last night. So.
Okay, and then going back to the Sarah's business, we have the luxury of time. The last slide. So if I understand correctly,
have you read that? I think
I remember correctly that for any parameter that he reports in the table, it's just the average of everything in the literature, right?
Yes.
Wow. So that means...
And then when you actually look through the list of things, where it's, you know, here's the cluster, here's the reference, I just glanced at it last night to make sure it was actually saying the things that I wanted it to say for this slide. There's a lot of things where it's so-and-so, 1975, and I'm sure we can do better
right,
23 years later.
So the
point is that they're not... He doesn't exclude data because it's 20 years old when...
Right, so I think the thing to do, sociologically, is since everyone goes to this catalog, if you want people to believe your number, you don't publish the actual number. You publish a number that went average with the Harris data.
I would argue that what you should do, and I think this is being done, and this is something that Ivan King mentioned when he was here, is to sit down with space-based things, actually remeasure all the clusters you can get.
Arnav wants to do that.
And the point is, I like my data because my data has all been measured the exact same way. I don't have to worry about 30 people scattered over 40 years coming up with different ways to measure the surface brightness or the number of stars or something. Having everything done in one single fashion gives you a better idea. Either you believe it all, or you believe it to whatever confidence level you're willing to believe it, or you just say it's wrong. Whereas if it's been pulled together from a bunch of different sources, you have to evaluate each source individually. So.
Is it possible to estimate the error bar of your C values from simulations?
From the simulations, let me think here.
Using like delta chi-square test.
Oh, to basically just say I've put in a bunch of different models. The problem is doing that the error bars that the chi-squared gives me are much smaller than I believe. The chi-squared varies much quicker around the minimum.
But in your simulation, you can't interpolate
everything. So that's saying the point is this is the error bar I believe because I've put it in, I've gotten it out. It should scatter reasonably consistent. So again, this is in W, but W kind of is tracks concentration well. Okay, anything else? Then I'm done.
Thank you.